Case number 20-3060, Cassandra Thompson versus Fresh Products LLC et al. 12 minutes for the plaintiff, 3 minutes for amicus, and 15 minutes for the defendants. Mr. Dubeau, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Dubeau, and I represent the appellant Cassandra Thompson. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for the amicus and 3 minutes for rebuttal. While Thompson has presented several issues on appeal, there are two threshold questions: whether Thompson timely filed her claims and whether the court improperly weighed the facts when she presented additional circumstantial and statistical evidence of discriminatory animus. One of the issues for Thompson's timeliness question is of critical importance for all employees across this circuit. Can employers privately contract with employees to prospectively waive the statutory limitations and pre-suit process established by Congress for ADA and ADEA claims? Pursuant to this court's holding and reasoning in Logan v. MGM, that Title VII's limitations, periods, and remedies are substantive rights that cannot be waived, this court should hold that the ADA and ADEA's limitations and remedies cannot be prospectively waived. As to the second question, the trial court not only weighed the facts, but made factual determinations when the citations to the record did not support such determinations. The Supreme Court in Anderson v. Liberty Lobby held that courts cannot weigh facts on summary judgment. Rather, courts must review facts in a light most favorable to the non-moving party. Thompson presented both circumstantial and statistical evidence to satisfy the heightened reduction in force burden, even though she only needed to show one. Chief among the impermissibly weighed and wrongly adopted facts is the Thompson circumstantial evidence. Disbelieving Thompson's testimony that she requested part-time due to a medical condition simply because appellees said they didn't hear this request. Adopting an incorrect reason for termination when appellee's own records state reason for termination wanted part-time. Deciding that Thompson communicated that she could not work the new shift, even though Schaeferle in her deposition testified that she never explicitly said she could not work those hours. Deciding that a comparator, Kristen Brown, could work the new shift, even though the citation in the record from the court shows that Schaeferle said in an email she did not believe that Brown could actually work the new shift. And then deciding that plaintiff was the only person who did not fill out a shift preference survey when we presented approximately 6 people who did not fill out the survey or it said they couldn't work the new shift, and the court simply just disregarded that. Any of these facts should have been sufficient to satisfy the circumstantial evidence that was necessary. And if that weren't enough, Thompson also presented statistical evidence that showed discriminatory animus.
Counsel, let me just interrupt a minute. You have several claims. It's not clear to me which cause of action you're actually talking about right now.
Sure, Your Honor. We're talking about really all of her claims for disability, age, race. For discrimination cases, typically we have to show the McDonnell-Douglas prima facie elements of protected class, qualify.
You're suggesting that proof of one is proof of all?
So we presented statistics that are in our brief that would have shown for age and race. As for her disability and her perceived disability claim, a lot of those facts that I just brought up, especially for Kristen Brown, are indicative of her perceived disability claim. Where Thompson requested part-time, she testified because of her medical condition. Appellees say they don't hear that. That in and of itself is a disputed fact that should have gone to the jury for her perceived disability claim. Kristen Brown requested part-time hours because of education purposes, not because of a disability. When you look at that, we have a document showing Schaeferle who she considered for termination. Kristen Brown is not included in there, even though she also requested part-time hours.
So did Brown, in fact, get part-time hours? I mean, I thought the employer's effect defense was that that they did not have part-time hours, period, except for this issue about Blunt or Bunch, but that production line workers, there were no part-time hours, period. And that is that disputed?
Your Honor, we don't dispute that. Brown did not get part-time hours after that request was made. But the issue is that when it says on the reason that our client was terminated, which was wanted part-time hours, and we have...
Okay, so that would go to the termination, but not to the disability discrimination prior to termination.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Where did that list come from, the initial list of people to be laid off?
It was a document that was produced by appellees. It was a document that was created by Schaeferle, who was the manager, who was managing the upcoming reduction in force. She put together a list of individuals that they were considering to terminate.
But didn't she also say something about not having Thompson on the list because she was very productive?
Schaeferle did send an email indicating that she was not sure why Thompson was being included on the list. And it said that they couldn't come up with a legitimate reason to keep her on there because her production level was high and her attendance was strong.
Right. However, so that's why I was asking who made...
Sorry, I froze a bit. So Schaeferle made the consideration spreadsheet, and she then also sent it up to the higher powers to take a look at it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your answer. I think maybe we were both speaking at the same time. Who made the list?
Schaeferle, who was the manager, made the list and sent the list up to the president and the operations manager.
And is that the same list that when she testifies, at least from time to time, you know, she says, well, why is it checked in this column and that column? And you know, she's pretty fuzzy on it. Obviously, you know, it's a lot of people and a lot of columns, but that's the same list we're talking about.
Yeah, there are a couple lists, Your Honor. Of course, there's the consideration list, and that is one. She testified a few times that these were living documents and that they changed from time to time. And again, all of these
as a practical matter, this is my question. In the end, is what we had a failure to communicate that if she had said, okay, I'm ready to work shift one, don't fire me, there's a lot of indication that they wouldn't. And on the other hand, the company, apparently, even though they thought she was a good employee, didn't press her to say, hey, come on, you know, can you work full time? I mean, is that a fair characterization of what really happened here?
Your Honor, if there was a miscommunication, it would still lead toward discrimination. When our client is saying she wants part-time because of a disability, a medical condition, and then they're saying, you know, she for Brown wants it because of an education purpose, that's not linked to a medical condition. And if there is a miscommunication that, you know, Schaeferle wasn't sure what, you know, was going on and if she should be able to work or not, then she is making that inference for both Brown and both our client, because in an email, she says she doesn't believe that Kristen Brown can actually work the new shift schedule either. And so if Schaeferle is confused about both individuals and our client
but
is disabled.
But if Brown gets laid off in the end also, kind of where's the damage from this alleged miscomparator?
The damage, Your Honor, is that Brown was not considered for termination and she was not terminated. So even though they're the same, the difference
she was not terminated because she decided that she could work the full shift despite her educational preference.
In the citation to the record, the email, Schaeferle says, I don't believe that she can actually work the new shift. So Schaeferle doesn't believe that she can actually do it. So it shouldn't matter that she
but
turned
in. But in fact, she does come back and do it. That's what you just told me, wasn't it?
It doesn't matter.
Brown was not laid off, is what you just said.
Your Honor, it shouldn't matter what happens after. It matters in what is making the determination. That's how it's decided for discriminatory animus. If she's making the decision based off of our client's disability or off of our client's other protected classes, then that's what determines if there's discrimination or not, not whether she works it or not after. And our client wasn't given the chance to work that shift after.
On the race and age claims, does it matter that a number of the people that were retained?
Again, I apologize. I think it's freezing again. For the retention, it shouldn't matter because, again, at the end of the day, they're making the selection decision on our client based off of her race and her disability and her age. And so when they're selecting her because of those decisions as opposed to others, then that doesn't matter. And then on top of that, with the statistical evidence that's presented in our brief.
Well, my question was directed to that statistical evidence. What isn't that the your main point, or do you have any other evidence of age or race discrimination?
For age and race discrimination, again, it goes back to the comparator Kristen Brown, where they make the same request for part-time hours, but only our client is terminated. And then for statistical evidence, prior to the termination, 55% were under the age of 40, and all of the individuals who were terminated were over the age of 40. You would expect half of that list to be under the age of 40. And I would like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal. We'd simply request that the trial court's decision is reversed and remanded.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jim Tucker with the EEOC. It seems like it's fairly straightforward. There doesn't seem to be much of a contest over whether or not the analysis is a court of Blood and Logan regarding Title VII applies equally to the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the question of whether or not the limitations period under the disability statute constitute a substantive non-waivable right. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the ADEA, the Age Act, which again, the commission believes should reach the same result. All of the criteria that this court looked at in Logan in discussing whether or not a statute and its limitations provision should be treated as a non-waivable substantive right are equally satisfied by the Age Act. It is a statute that provides rights and remedies, and it is a statute that has an integrated limitations provision. It's part of a larger administrative scheme created by Congress to facilitate and emphasize informal resolution of claims as opposed to, or as an alternative to litigation. Now, there's some—
Your characterization of how the thing works in relation to federal legislation is pretty clearly correct, at least as far as I'm concerned. But what about state law claims? Can't these limitations still have some effect on state law claims?
Well, I know that the district court relied on, in one instance, the Myers case, which was a state law discrimination claim and involving a waiver just like this, another 60-day or a six-month waiver of claims. And in that case, the court did conclude that that particular state law did control the ability to amend or to alter by contract a limitations period under that particular, but because the state law supported it. But it is a state-by-state issue or determination. So whether or not it's a possibility, yes, but the commission didn't really take a position on the state law issues. It's really more concerned with more national
law. I understand. Thank you.
If there are any questions on the issues, I'd just like to point out one small factor in response to the appellee's brief and a characterization or suggestion that the ADEA is a statute that's amenable to this type of agreement because the 60-day limitation period for filing suit doesn't, or excuse me, the 60-day period by which the individual has to wait to file suit under the Age Act before proceeding with their claim fits within a 6-month limitation period. I just want to remind the court that the limitation period at issue covers not only filing of lawsuits, but also filing of charges of discrimination. And just as in the Logan decision, in that case, the district court concluded that the charge was filed at day 216, which was within the 300-day statutory period, but outside the 6-month limitation period, and therefore granted summary judgment. The same 300-day limitation period applies under the ADEA, so that same consideration is here. It's not simply about a 60-day window for filing suits. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Carrie Yerudia, and I'm here today on behalf of Fresh Products and Dawn Shaverly, who respectfully urge the court to affirm the decision of the district court granting summary judgment in their favor. As you know, this is a reduction in force case. Fresh Products set about to lay off as few employees as possible when the company switched to a new production shift schedule at the beginning of 2017. This was a thoughtful process. In the months leading up to the change, Fresh Products stopped filling vacant positions, surveyed employees on numerous occasions, and identified employees who could either not work the new schedule or who could not work it for very long, and made the best effort possible to minimize the disruption to the workforce. Ultimately, the company only had to lay off 5 employees. 3 of these employees, including appellant, were selected because of their unique circumstances. 1 employee volunteered, another employee needed to report to prison several weeks after the layoff, and appellant, who never selected a new shift and affirmatively indicated she could not work a new shift. Fresh Products then only had to select 2 other employees based upon productivity numbers in order to meet the company's financial needs and leave the rest of the workforce unimpacted. Fresh Products did not select appellant for layoff for impermissible or unlawful reasons. I submit to you that had she selected one of the new shifts, she would likely be gainfully employed by Fresh Products right now. It's as simple as that.
Isn't there evidence that she was not the only person who didn't select a new shift? And there
were several surveys that were given, and the evidence is clear that not all employees responded to those surveys in a timely manner. Ms. Thompson, however, did respond to the survey and affirmatively indicated, "I can't work one of these new shifts." The evidence is also undisputed from Ms. Shaverly that after the surveys came back, if there was any question about whether an employee initially could or initially couldn't, like we heard from Mr. Dubow with regard to the employee who initially requested part-time, Ms. Shaverly testified that she went to these employees one by one to see if she could get a commitment for one of the new work schedules before the new program was rolled out. And Ms. Brown was, in fact, not laid off because she did ultimately select one of the new shifts. So it's the employer's position that Ms. Brown and Ms. Thompson were treated exactly the same when it came to
the layoff. Did they go back and ask Ms. Thompson, can you work one of the new shifts?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. If you look in the brief, after the 2 survey periods were over, Ms. Shaverly walked the floor of the plant and affirmatively communicated with every production worker about whether they could work one of the new shifts. And that's the exhibit where you can see after that communication, Ms. Shaverly wrote in the margin, wants part-time. That was the final confirmation after the completion of the 2 other surveys that she could not work the new shift.
And what's the citation for that?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that, Your Honor. I know I have it written down here somewhere, and I will find it for you.
Okay, go ahead with the rest of your argument.
But counsel, there's no indication that Thompson was told that it's either work the new shift or you're going to be laid off.
I believe that all employees were informed that in the initial meetings leading up to the layoffs, The company had all employee meetings where they talked about the need to move the full-time 8-hour, 5-day shift to a full-time.
Can you tell me where in the record she was told that it's all or nothing?
I don't believe anyone ever used the term all or nothing, but Ms. Thompson did agree on her deposition that this was a full-time position, and she understood that, whether it was 5 full days or 4 full days. The production line can't run with employees working partial shifts just based upon the nature of the product that's being produced. I wanted to address the primary reason I believe the district court's decision should be affirmed, and that's the appellant's failure to meet the heightened burden that is employed in these reduction in force cases and has been in the Sixth Circuit since at least 1990 when the Barnes versus GenCorp decision was reached. In that case, the employee has to produce additional direct, circumstantial, or statistical evidence showing discrimination. It's the employer's position that here the appellant can't do so, first because there's lots of case law that suggests that a 5-employee sample is simply too small to analyze. And the Barnes case goes on to require courts to make sure that the statistics show a significant disparity and that they eliminate the most common non-discriminatory reasons for the disparity. Appellant would have you ignore the lawful non-discriminatory reasons for which each of the 5 employees selected were laid off. This failure cuts across all of appellant's claims. Quickly, with regard to the age and race claims, where we only have the statistical evidence. With an age claim, employees are required to show that age was the but-for cause of the layoff. Here, the evidence is undisputed that Fresh Product retained many employees who are over 40, including several employees who were older than Ms. Thompson. There's also significant case law cited in our brief indicating that comparison of the relative ages of workers laid off and retained in a reduction in force case does not provide evidence of age discrimination without additional information. And here, what's interesting with regard to the age and race claims, unlike many of the discrimination claims we see, there are no stray remarks here. There are no racist comments. There are no negative comments with regard to any medical impairment or disability. And the majority of production workers at Fresh Products are, in fact, minority employees. Most identify as African-American, Hispanic, or multiracial. I do want to point out and correct an error in the appellant's reply brief, wherein she indicates that all of the individuals who were laid off are non-Caucasian. That's not true. Constance Canary is Caucasian, and she was the individual who was scheduled to report to prison or jail sometime after the layoff went into effect. This misrepresentation or incorrect statement of the facts does skew the statistical analysis with regard.
Well, I'm sorry, you were frozen in part during what you were saying, but
my understanding
is that she wasn't really laid off in the sense that they didn't choose her. She told them she was going to jail or something.
Right. That's essentially for the 3 employees. One said, hey, I'll take the layoff. I'll go back to another job. Cassandra Thompson said, I can't work the new shift. And Constance Canary said, I'm going to jail in a few weeks. And, you know, the employer wanted to make sure that the employees who could have a long-term commitment with the company could maintain those jobs. With regard to the disability discrimination claim, as a preliminary and I would say dispositive matter, there's not any evidence or additional evidence of disability discrimination as required by the heightened reduction in force standard. In her brief, appellant suggests that this standard is permissive or optional, but that's just inconsistent with several Sixth Circuit disability discrimination claims involving reductions in force, including the Barlia versus MWI veterinary supply case, which was authored by Judge Boggs in 2018. Appellant also failed to raise an issue of fact that she's even disabled at all. Appellant testified she has arthritis, but she offered no medical testimony regarding how, if at all, the condition substantially limits a major life activity. And her own testimony, which is sometimes sufficient in these cases, is insufficient as well. Appellant simply testified that her arthritis affects her ability to, quote, live a full life. No elaboration in an affidavit or otherwise as to what major life activity is impacted and how. She also said that her arthritis limits her ability to lift at work, but the evidence was undisputed that appellant had no lifting restrictions. She was able to perform all of the job requirements with regard to lifting at Fresh Products, and she testified she never spoke to a physician about her ability to do her job at Fresh Products, which she performed adequately on a full-time basis up until the time of the layoff. With regard to the regarded as prong of the disability claim, both appellant and the EEOC correctly point out that the district court cited a pre-ADA amendments case when citing the regarded as standard. Reviewing lots of these cases, that's a fairly common error, and I would submit it is harmless in this case because there is no evidence that Fresh Products believed appellant had a physical or mental impairment, period. Indeed, Ms. Schaeferle testified when asked by Mr. Dubot that she believed appellant simply didn't want to work the 10-hour shift. Appellant speculates that Ms. Schaeferle may have assumed this was because of a health reason, but 2 points there. We know that's not true because appellant explained the real reason, the shift conflicted with her babysitting obligations. And two, as recently reiterated by this court in the Brown versus Kelsey Hayes case decided on May 26th, mere conjecture that the employer's representation or explanation is a pretext is insufficient reason to deny summary judgment. I would also urge the court to review the Babb versus Marysville case, which cited the correct standard in claims post-ADA Amendments Act. It's quite instructive when addressing the amount of information an employer has or doesn't have with regard to the employee's medical impairment. In that case, the employee had a visual impairment, which was referenced in her performance evaluations, referenced in her disciplinary discussions, and there was even an email after the fact where the employer referenced whether plaintiff's vision impairment caused her performance problems. There is simply no
counsel, if I could take you back a minute to the RIF numbers. Am I right really in understanding that at some point you said there were five who were laid off, but one was going to prison and one volunteered, that even if we include Ms. Thompson as a real RIF, you only had three people that were RIFed. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, there were two other individuals who were RIFed because of their production numbers.
Right, I understand. I'm just saying that the real number is three. Your adversary, I take it, says we shouldn't look at the three who were actually laid off. We should look at those who were, quote, selected for layoff, which would be five. Do you have any take as to what the law there is?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I would submit to you that the working list of potential layoffs that was kept for many months before the actual layoff determination was made isn't really suggestive of anything. If you look at the deposition testimony, this was a list of employees who had either poor attendance or had poor productivity numbers. That's why the HR director initially questioned why Cassandra Thompson should even be on the list, because her production numbers were good. But at that point, she had already indicated to her supervisor that she wanted part-time schedule and she couldn't work the one of the new shifts. So I don't think that there was ever a number of employees who, you know, were actually considered for layoff. There was a list prepared of certain individuals whose production numbers and attendance may make them candidates for layoff if they didn't quit or get terminated before the ultimate layoff occurred.
Counsel, I think I...
Go ahead. Did your emphasis on, you said, well, Schaeferle in the end walked the floor, talked to everybody. You cite talk to Thompson, and effectively you interpret that as Thompson said, no, I want part time. Was Thompson deposed on that point?
Yes, she was, Your Honor. And she did not dispute, and she did not dispute informing Ms. Schaeferle that she wanted to work part time. She testified in deposition that she asked to work part time, although she did not communicate it to Ms. Schaeferle, that she needed to work the part time hours because the new shift schedule wasn't consistent with her babysitting obligations to her grandchildren. She did not communicate that back.
Counselor, just on that latter point, didn't she also even indicate at one point the hours, if she got part-time, what the hours had to be?
Yes, Your Honor, she did. She wanted the hours to be consistent with her current full-time schedule so she could continue to, well, now we know, so she could continue to watch the children. But when she told Ms. Schaeferle she wanted part-time hours, she did, in fact, provide her with her preferred part-time hours, yes. Just in sum, I see that my time is up. The evidence is undisputed that Fresh Products did not retain any production worker who could not work the new schedule. The district court properly found that considering these undisputed facts, Fresh Products' decision to select appellant was both lawful and reasonable. We would ask that you affirm the district court's decision.
Counsel, who made that list, that first list that she was on?
Ms. Schaeferle made that list. It was encompassed by lists that were provided by supervisors who were asked to identify employees who had high absenteeism rates and low productivity.
So how did she get on that list?
She got on that list because her supervisor initially put her on that list. Because if you look at his testimony and also Ms. Thompson's testimony, pretty quick after the company had these all-employee meetings, she went to her supervisor and said, hey, can you ask about part-time? About the same time Kristen was doing the same. So the supervisor put Ms. Thompson on that initial list because she had come to him saying, I can't work the new schedule. Please put me, or at least could you see if there's any part-time opportunities, which there weren't for either the employee who wanted to go back to school or for Ms. Thompson.
Okay, thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. Just like to clarify a few points. Schaeferle's testimony, I asked her, did she ever tell you she couldn't work the floor tens? And she answered, she did not. She told me she wanted part-time. That's in document 37, page ID 383. She never told Schaeferle that she couldn't work the new shift. It's just not in the evidence. Appellees have not cited any direct evidence where she said she could not work the new shift. The shift preference was a shift preference. It was asking, what would you prefer? They were trying to decide what hours to do for the new shifts. And that can be found in 47-1 and Schaeferle's deposition, document 37, page 357. So it's a preference. It's not a, this is all or nothing. You have to do this. As for sample size, this court has no precedent stating there has to be a sample size. There has to be a number that's sufficient for sample size. It does make it less indicative of discrimination, but there should not be any type of standard like that saying five or fewer, we can't consider it. Because if the person is required to show additional circumstantial or statistical evidence, then any employer could just go around and riff the five oldest people, not hire someone for a few months, and then do it again and continually lower the age. And our case is even consistent with other Sixth Circuit cases, such as Skalka and Payton, which were addressed in the briefs. And of course, Schollenbarger, where the statistical evidence was looked at for the population as a whole, to be statistically relevant and not just the three or five people who are selected. If the population shows a higher level of under 40 people, then we expect the employer to RIF around 55% of that list to be under the age of 40. And that didn't happen here. They were all over the age of 40. And all the ones who were involuntarily terminated were African-American. As we put it in our brief, we put involuntarily terminated, not five people, you know, none of the people who were terminated were Caucasian. We put involuntarily terminated. So that's what was in the brief.
And would you agree that involuntarily terminated at best is three people, that is Thompson plus the other two that are referred to?
If we're saying just involuntary, then yes, it would be those three. They were all African-American, all over the age of 40. And again, even if you're looking at just three, then you should expect at least one Caucasian who would be RIFed, and you would expect one or two to be under the age of 40. Rather, we have all the individuals who are over the age of 40, which, consistent with Schollenbarger, should have satisfied the statistical evidence of the RIF burden.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted.